Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times bestselling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida, where it has often been said by many people the most dangerous time of the year in Florida is when the legislature is in session, and that leads into Craig's most recent column from the Florida Phoenix.
Yeah, definitely. When the legislature's in session, board up your windows like it's hurricane season. I wrote about the president of the Senate, Wilton Simpson, who is often described as an egg farmer from Trilby, which is sort of like saying, you know, McDonald's is a burger joint. He runs this massive chicken and egg population, a chicken and egg operation there. He's worth like $30 million. And he's got a million chickens in these coops, and he is almost literally carrying water for Big Sugar. And I make the point of, you know, he is an agribusiness, and Big Sugar is an agribusiness. Yep. So they speak each other's language, and they have been rewarding him handsomely with campaign contributions. And he sort of produced this legislation right in the middle of the legislative session instead of at the beginning when people could look at it, that really kind of guarantees Big Sugar will continue getting first pick on the water supply whenever there's a drought, which is not fair to the Everglades and to the 9 million people who live around that area, but is sort of an indication of how he's going to be if he gets elected state agriculture commissioner, which is the job he's running for now.
Right. There's a lot to work with here. You're talking about water coming out of Lake Okeechobee, the big sugar agribusiness lands are hundreds of thousands of acres just south of Lake Okeechobee. Big Sugar controls the flow of that water, when it comes out, where it goes to, and acts something as a cork to getting water to the Everglades in any kind of a natural flow. When Big Sugar says, we don't want the water that's stocked up there, that polluted water goes to either side of the state and is what causes a lot of algae outbreaks. It's that runoff, that polluted runoff, that has caused a lot of the manatee die off in the Indian River Lagoon. So this Big Sugar land mass property holding and Big Sugar determining how water out of Lake Okeechobee gets used really connects to essentially every environmental conservation wildlife topic in South Florida, surely. And like you said, which is really surprising about this bill, this is a rabbit out of a hat. This thing came from nowhere, dark of the night, all of a sudden. And the, you know, environmental groups I follow in the state, Audubon Florida and Friends of the Everglades, and those groups were outraged immediately because they had almost no time to react to this legislation or proposed legislation.
They didn't even warn the South Florida Water Management District, which is the state agency in charge of Everglades restoration. They're partners with U.S. Army Corps of Engineers on this project. And even they didn't know this was coming. And Simpson has tried to style this as a, you know, sort of an Florida versus the federal government. We need to make sure Florida gets its share. It's like it's supposed to be an equal partnership and you're messing it up.
We've talked about this before, billions of dollars and decades have been spent weaving this patchwork of Everglades restoration together and where water goes and stormwater treatment. And this goes here in percentages and feet above mean and wet season, dry season, multiple agencies. And this threw something of a cherry bomb in that careful network because it upends all of that work that literally thousands of people have spent tens of thousands of hours figuring out the best way to go about this. And this new bill that was introduced in the dark of the night ruffles that altogether.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk about something more cheerful. Let's talk
something
about
something more cheerful. Yes.
An environmental success story.
And history in the making here in Welcome to Florida. Yes. Our first ever two-time guest, Jack Davis, joined us almost a year ago exactly with his Pulitzer Prize winning book about the Gulf of Mexico. He is back, Craig, with a brand new book.
It's called The Bald Eagle, The Improbable Journey of America's Bird, which it is a pretty good title because it really is an improbable story. When, you know, we think we know about eagles, we don't know anything about eagles. And Jack is here to tell the story.
Jack Davis, the book is The Bald Eagle, The Improbable Journey of America's Bird. You can find a link to purchase in the show notes.
Jack, you rightfully won a Pulitzer Prize for your last book about a history of the Gulf of Mexico. What led you to decide that your follow-up would be a book about the bald eagle? It seems like a kind of a left turn there.
Well, of course, you know, bald eagles live around the Gulf of Mexico. And, you know, and when you and I were growing up in the Gulf region, we didn't see bald eagles. They were more or less missing in action. But, you know, since the 1990s and clearly the 21st century, they've come back in force and a wonderful sight to see them. I wanted to write an environmental book that would have a broad appeal across the political spectrum. So there would be a dialogue, you know, across the divide. And because whether you're a red, white, and blue American or tree hugger or birder or all of those things, you love the bald eagle. When we see one in the sky, we, you know, it's one of those sights, you know, it's a poke the guy in the ribs next to you sort of sight, right? But it's also this wonderful environmental success story. And in some ways, it's a story of redemption. And so I wanted to give readers a break from the usual grim, tragic environmental stories. And of course, rightfully, those kind of stories have written our environmental past has some horrendous moments in it, but it also has some uplifting moments that I wanted to share. And the bald eagle's story is both a tragic and a wonderful one.
I like how you kind of expose some of the myths that people have about and have passed on about, you know, how our founding fathers viewed the eagle, the whole story about Ben Franklin and the turkey, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, let's not get that away. Let's make the listeners read the book, but they'll probably be surprised by the true story behind Ben Franklin and the bald eagle and the Great Seal of the United States.
Yes,
which is a story I didn't know until at least about the Great Seal and his preferences and until I did this research. And that was just a wonderful and fun discovery.
I'll bet. Now, I have to ask you about one of the villains of the piece, who is from Florida, Gilbert Pearson.
Yeah. So T. Gilbert Pearson was longtime early president of the National Association of the Audubon Societies, as it was called back in his day in the early 20th century, from Archer, Florida, Eagle Country, you know, a place that was wall to wall with longleaf pines, which is really an ideal nesting tree for bald eagles. He was no fan of the bald eagle when others in the early 20th century were worried about the dramatic decline of the bald eagle population in the lower 48 and called for its protection. We're all equally concerned about the bounty that the territory of Alaska had put on bald eagles, which ran from 1917 to 1952. And the territory ultimately paid bounties on over 128,000 bald eagles.
Oh my God.
And, so people were coming forward and saying, we need to protect the eagle. We need to stop the bounty in Alaska. And he wouldn't do it. Only until the last minute when Congress was in 1940 was considering the Bald Eagle Protection Act, did he change his tune. Otherwise, he fought what he called the sentimentalists, who thought they were overreacting to what was happening to the bald eagle.
But why this hostility to eagles? I mean, it seems so odd now, but you know, it was a widespread belief back then that what eagles were stealing sheep and children and things like that.
It's exactly, you know, the bald eagle is a bird, so-called bird of prey or an apex predator. It was accused of all sorts of crimes, and that's how they were described: crimes against humanity. Stealing livestock, such as you mentioned, sheep and calves and pigs and chickens. And of those, only a livestock that the bald eagle can carry away is chickens. Everything else is too heavy. You know, you see these YouTube videos, these doctored YouTube videos today of eagles carrying away all sorts of things, you know, full size deer. and there were all sorts of reports of this happening, and they were completely apocryphal. And T. Gilbert Pearson was one of the people responsible for spreading these myths.
Wow.
He maintained that a bald eagle had carried away, what was it, a pig or a sheep? I can't remember. That was twice its size and carried it for 5 miles, which is utterly impossible. But also mothers.
I'm glad we've gotten past the idea of people embracing myths as opposed to science.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Well, let me tell you, the science wasn't so great in that day because I mean, even Audubon said such things, and even ornithologists were warning mothers. This is the 19th century, of course, but it runs on into the 20th. Even ornithologists warn mothers, don't leave your infant unattended outside. Less an eagle carried it away.
Oh my God.
and one of the most popular readers of the day for immigrants trying to learn English and children was McGuffey's. And there was a story for decades in McGuffey's about an eagle carrying away a child to its nest. And in the image, the drawing of this mm-hmm. eagle in action, the girl being carried away is at least 6-7 years old. And then one of Thomas Edison's earliest silent films, 1906 or 1908, I can't remember, titled Rescued from an Eagle's Nest, was that very story of an eagle snatching away a baby, left unattended outside the cabin of a lumberjack and taken to the nest. And the father saves the eagle. And what I loved about this—
Wait, you mean saves the baby? Saves the baby, not the eagle.
He saves the baby.
Save the eagle.
He saved
the eagle.
No. So he's in a scuffle in the nest on the cliff where the nest is located. He's in a scuffle with the eagle. And suddenly, this is a great early, you know, film effects. Suddenly, a club appears in his hand. It just appears like that. And he clubs the eagle unconscious and then kicks it over the ledge and saves his daughter. But the father was played by D.W. Griffith. And
really?
You remember who D.W. Griffith was?
Yeah, Birth of a Nation.
The guy who directed the famous film on Birth of a Nation that inspired the second incarnation of the Ku Klux Klan. And what I love about this, well, maybe not, is that he was panned by the critics. And so for his acting, and apparently he saw the writing on the wall and went into directing. And then a few years later, directed The Birth of a Nation. And perhaps if he'd stayed an actor, we wouldn't have had that movie.
Wow.
Yikes.
you talk about bounties on eagles, and you know that goes beyond a hunting season. This is promoting the reckless, wanton mass slaughter of animals that has occurred in this country throughout its history. Coyotes, wolves have been subject to similar treatment, but it is remarkable that such an attitude could exist for a symbol of the nation. Mm-hmm. We've got this on our money, we've got this on our flags, and yet we somehow distance it or compartmentalize it in our mind that we like the imagery, but we don't like the actual animal. How did that occur in the mindset of these people to think that, well, it's great that it represents us, but we don't actually want this thing around?
Well, I mean, you said it exactly. In fact, the original title, the working title of the book was Bird of Paradox. That is, you know, the marketing folks didn't like it.
Well, I love it. You can put me in that column.
I mean, you're exactly right. I mean, the bald eagle is forced to live in these, as I say, these parallel universes, you know, the symbol universe and the species, the living species universe. And it was treated quite differently in both of those universes. It is one of the great ironies in American history that the bald eagle was treated like any other predator, wolves and coyotes and mountain lions, and it was hunted down. You know, it was marked for eradication, and an eagle seen was an eagle to be shot. And people saw it as their duty to shoot that eagle because they were protecting their neighbor's chickens. You know, so many people had chickens, you know, in their backyards, or the local farmer's livestock, or the baby next door, whatever. Right. But as a physical figure, it's a very striking bird, right? And it's an all-American bird. It lives only in North America. Now, in eagles and heraldry or on coats of arms, and goes way back to the ancient. But typically, those eagles were non-ornithological. You know, they were a non-species. They were just a generic eagle. And so it wasn't unusual to choose an eagle for the Great Seal of the United States. But Charles Thompson who did choose the eagle, who was Secretary of the Continental Congress, insisted that it be an American bald eagle. You know, and it's very distinctive. It has its white head and white tail and dark body, the only bird in North America with those features. Mm-hmm. And it's a large bird. It's a handsome bird.
It is.
Agree. It has this noble appearance.
It's muscular. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Muscular. Exactly.
Broad chest, broad shoulders. I mean, it's got the furrowed brow, serious expression, that angular nose. Yeah. It does portray a lot of these traits that Americans like to, it's a badass, right? I mean, the bald eagle looks like a badass.
Yeah. It's a badass bird.
It has, as I say, it has that don't tread on me stare.
Yeah.
Because of the superorbital ridge above its eyes, which is a sunscreen for them, or sun visor, excuse me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but for us, it gives it that look.
Yeah.
Makes it fit really nicely with a young republic that's trying to assert its own identity separate of European powers or influences.
Yeah.
It's an all-American bird. And it says, you know, it's a bird that you don't want to argue with, right?
Right, yeah.
And it's a great symbol of national unity and freedom and courage. Mm-hmm. But the irony here, going back to that paradox, is that this is the bird of freedom, right, that we denied it freedom. Mm-hmm. Until the Bald Eagle Protection Act of 1940.
Yeah, I always thought it was a great symbol, not for all the reasons, aesthetic reasons so many ascribe to it, but because, like America, it prefers to steal its food. And I thought for a country founded on stolen land, what better representative than a bird which prefers to steal its food? And you can see this in nature as the bald eagle tries to take scraps of fish or whatever it else is going for from other birds. I think that is an incredibly apropos for this nation.
Or whole fish. And I mean, that was another reason why people didn't like the species, is because it's a scavenger, as you said, and that's seen beneath the dignity of the country's bird, you know, the country's representative.
It also has an incredibly thin call. If you've ever heard a bald eagle, it sounds more like a blue jay. Wait. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell about the manufactured call on the movie.
I think the perfect example is the opening credits of the Colbert Report. The eagle flies with its wings spread wide across the TV screen, introducing the Colbert Report. And you hear this fierce cry. That's not a bald eagle. That's a red-tailed hawk. Mm-hmm. Dubbed in. You know, it's the voice stand-in for the.
Yeah.
But as I say in the book, it's quite appropriate for a show that traded on fakery, right?
True. Absolutely.
That's true. I mean, Northern Exposure, the same thing. If you remember the TV show Northern Exposure, every time they had an eagle, and I believe there was one in the opening credits. You know, it's a red-tailed hawk, and the prop people, or the sound effects people, I should say, in Hollywood, figured this out a long time ago. The wimpy cry of an eagle is not going, bald eagle just won't work.
Yeah.
For the image.
It doesn't sound the way it looks.
No,
it doesn't. It doesn't. But, you know, that's from our point of perspective, as I write in the book, from wildlife, it's, you know, it's a distinctive sound. Most wildlife hearing that, it's going to recover.
Yeah, exactly. But if you ever see one in nature and pair that call up with what you hear with what you see, it is a complete non sequitur. You know, that little
thing. It's like the Mike Tyson of the bird world. It's
good point.
Big and fierce, but it sounds kind of like this.
Yeah.
Now let me ask you about a guy who is clearly one of the heroes of the book and is also a Florida man, the Canadian retiree who moved to Sarasota with a mission.
Tampa. Yeah. Charles Burley, who is a retired banker from Winnipeg. At age 59 in the 1930s, just about 60 years old, retired to Florida. He's not a scientist. He's not an ornithologist. He is a birder, and he immediately starts climbing, you know, 60, 70, 80 foot tall longleaf and loblolly pines to band eaglets. And nobody was doing this systematically in those days. And
why did he do this? Why did he feel compelled to do this thing?
Well, as a birder, he had obviously an interest in bird life, and eagles are of course quite common in Canada. So he's familiar with the eagles. He knew that the eagle population had been in decline because everything that we talked about. This is before the Bald Eagle Protection Act of 1940. And he's a retiree. He needs something to do, right? Mm-hmm. And he did this for 20 years.
Yeah, but most people to go out and play golf.
Oh, I know. As I say in the book, he did something that no other retiree did in Florida, and that was climb trees. And he did this until age 79. And he climbed, he estimated 1,100 trees and abandoned over 1,200 eaglets. And what he did was extremely important to science because science didn't know anything about the migration patterns of bald eagles, and his Florida eagles helped give us a better understanding of where eagles go between breeding season. But he also helped him keep an inventory of the population. He's noticing it declining dramatically in the 1950s. And he is, as far as I can tell, the first person to make a link between the declining bald eagle population and DDT.
Wow.
And this is before Rachel Carson
talks about him in Silent Spring. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, you mentioned the Bald Eagle Protection Act of 1940, and then you mentioned DDT. So as perilous as the numbers were in 1940, they get much, much worse because of the widespread agricultural use of DDT through the 70s, right?
Till 72, yeah. And it's not just agriculture. You know, it's suburban neighborhoods. And, you know, Craig, I mean, we certainly remember the mosquito truck driving down.
Oh, yeah. The mosquito control truck and running around.
Noisy truck and with the fog behind it. And, you know.
And all the kids on bikes riding behind.
Yes. And it was very, very popular in home use. DDT was. It was everywhere. And it was used by the U.S. Forestry Service to control various, insect infections that would be detrimental to the timber harvest. Mm-hmm. And so it's all over. Yes. And so the best that we can tell is that in 1963, the nesting population of the lower 48 states dropped to a nadir, 487.
My gosh.
Across all 48 states. Mm-hmm. Now, back during the Revolution, that's the number that would be smaller for virtually any state in the country. And so the bald eagle is on the verge of extinction in the lower 48.
So Broly started sounding the alarm about this, but he didn't quite get the connection. He thought it was that the DDT was directly killing them.
That's right.
There was another Florida graduate student who figured out that it was the eggs, right?
Yes. So what happens is DDT gets into the environment, it gets into the water. Fish consume or are infected by DDT. They absorb it into their own bodies. Fish is the primary food source of bald eagles. And they eat the fish, and the DDT passes up the food chain. And in their body, it metabolizes to DDE, E as in Edward. And that gets into the bloodstream and into the shell gland of the female. And ultimately, she ended up laying thin-shelled eggs or deformed eggs. And so that had a devastating impact on the reproduction of the population, producing new generations.
Yeah, I know that was a similar cause and effect with osprey, which caused their numbers to collapse as well. Were any other
California condor too? I think, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, and also peregrine falcons.
Wasn't peregrine falcons also? Yeah. Okay.
And so, any sort of fishing bird would have been affected. Even wild rodents, could be contaminated. Listeners should know this. You do not point, if you got a rat issue in your house or, some sort of rodent issue in your house, don't poison them, because what happens is they go outside. If you care anything about wildlife, don't poison them, because they go outside, generally go outside to die of your home. And then an owl or red-tailed hawk or even a bald eagle comes along and grabs them. And that poison, you know, again, works up into the food chain, and it can cripple or even kill those yeah. raptors.
Yeah. Yeah. All of which you think about osprey. I'm here on Fernandina Beach. I don't go a day without seeing an osprey. It used to be yeah. rare. Bald eagles, not as common, but I know exactly where to go find one if yeah. I wanted to, 5 miles from my house. Peregrine falcons, again, all of these birds are widespread across the lower 48, or at least were, and now are again, thankfully, because yeah. DDT was recognized as the, yeah. the problem here and then banned. So how have the bald eagle numbers rebounded? It's still a special bird to see, but certainly yeah. not, you know, newspaper article worthy anymore.
Boy, it's always in a newspaper, but for various reasons. Let me give a plug to the Clean Water Act.
Endangered now. Yeah.
let me give a plug to the Clean Water Act, because it's 50th anniversary mm-hmm. in October. Phenomenal legislation. We haven't achieved the goals, but still it changed things. Without the Clean Water Act, we probably wouldn't cleaned up places like Tampa Bay, bays and bayous, rivers and lakes across the country. Nearly two-thirds of them were impaired by pollution by 1972 when the Clean Water Act was passed. And that meant, you know, the devastation of aquatic life and a major food source of bald eagles. So we could give it all the protection in the world. We could ban DDT, which also contaminated the water, of course. But if we hadn't cleaned up those ecosystems, the bald eagle population could not have rebounded as it has. It has really been spectacular. The bald eagle population in the lower 48 now exceeds 300,000. And continent-wide probably is around 500,000. And that's equal to the estimated population size at the time of European contact.
No kidding. You know,
the 18th century.
That's quite a comeback.
And we owe that to wildlife agencies in the individual states, also U.S. Fish and Wildlife that instituted in partnership, instituted restoration programs, relocating bald mm-hmm. eagles, relocating their eggs. Florida eagles donated unwittingly 270 in the 80s, 275 eggs that were hatched in Oklahoma, and the birds from those eggs were relocated to the other southern states where there were no nesting eagles, such as Alabama and Mississippi, which I think is really heroic on the part of all Florida bald eagles. They didn't lose any population because the eggs, both eggs were taken out of the nest mm-hmm. early on, and the female would lay a new clutch of eggs. And so now when you see a bald eagle, a nesting bald eagle, bald eagles will go back, and when they reach maturity, will go back to their natal territory and build nests. So these bald eagles, these eggs, and ultimately the eaglets that were relocated to, say, Alabama, Mississippi, imprinted on those territories. That became their natal territory. And so they come back. So when you see a nesting bald eagle in Alabama or Mississippi or Georgia or Louisiana, Oklahoma, there's a good chance that that bald eagle is the descendant of a Florida eagle.
Oh, my.
Amazing. Yeah. And I love that. I just love that. I didn't know about any of this until I started writing this book. And those eggs were taken from a 6-county area in north central Florida, where I live, around Marjorie Kinnon Rawlings, you know, Cross Creek
wow.
in that area. It's a wonderful story.
Speaking of great stories and Florida women, tell us about, is it Doris Manger? Is that how you
Manger,
say her name?
Manger. Yeah. 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 Oh, she was so fun to write about. And I interviewed her. She was 93, 94 years old and still going strong when I interviewed her. So Doris Manger, one of her many claims of fame, it was in 1979, she climbed a loblolly pine in central Florida. Jeff Klinkenberg was there covering this for the St. Pete Times, which I love. She climbed this tree, this 50-foot a loblolly pine, to live in a vacated eagle's nest for 6 days between Flag Day and the anniversary of the adoption of the Great Seal of the United States, to raise awareness about the plight of the bald eagle, but also to raise money to fund the construction of an aviary at the Florida Audubon Society, where she was the vice president and had worked for many years. She started the raptor rehabilitation at Florida Audubon in her backyard. And that got, she got so busy that needed to create an aviary. Yeah.
Advice from her dad. Her advice from her dad, which was, what was it, Epsom salt and it fixed everything.
Yes, yes. Her first name, the hawk, had a bad foot, and he said Epsom salt's the cure for everything. And so she soaked that hawk's, I think it was red tail, and in Epsom salt, and healed it and released it. And but this is one that age 60, yeah. she biked across the U.S. from the West Coast to the East Coast to raise awareness, stopping at Kmart stores who sponsored her to give lectures on the importance of birds of prey. And she did this in schools for decades, traveling across the country doing this and into her 90s.
6 days in an eagle nest, though, that seems a little
smelly.
Crazy. Yeah. Well, I was going to say crazy just because of the frequency of lightning in Florida.
Right. Well, you know, and as you know from reading the book, her maiden climb up that tree, it was a stormy day. And she was worried about this storm and everybody else was. And of course, the tree was swinging like, as I said, an old door on rusty hinges. But still brave of her. And this is how dedicated she was. I bet, you know, and again, she clocked who knows how many hundreds of thousands of miles on the road giving, as did many others, giving lectures about birds of prey and taking birds with her, yeah. You know, usually an owl and an eagle.
I was going to ask you about one other guy who wound up at Boyd Hill Nature Park.
Yeah.
In St. Petersburg.
Yes. Patrick Bradley, is a Vietnam veteran, combat veteran, who suffered horribly from PTSD and was sent up to the Canadian wilderness in the early 1970s to spend 3 years working on a project to complete a census of the bald eagle population. And so he lived out in the wilderness alone for those 3 years. It was really his salve. You know, it saved him from PTSD, as did the bald eagles. And so he went into he studied wildlife. And throughout his career, he's worked with raptors and in various capacities. At Boyd Hill, he started a program for other veterans suffering from PTSD. He brings them out. He's no longer at Boyd Hill.
He's at the one in Largo now, a park in Largo.
He's moved from there too.
Oh, okay.
But he still has his Avian Vets Association, in which he takes veterans suffering from PTSD and matches them with a raptor, a hawk, or an eagle, or an owl that is in rehab. As he said, I'm putting wounded bird together with wounded vet. And tells them, go, you know, at Boyd Hill, it's this wonderful nature park in the middle of the city with, you know, winding trails through the jungle, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. And he'll tell them, just take a walk with this bird on their arm. And some of them will be gone an hour or two. And they'll come out, they'll come back. And they really feel a profound effect, a soothing effect from being with this bird. And it's been a wonderful cure, if you will, for veterans. And I don't know how many at this point, you know, a couple of thousand veterans have walked with his birds.
Amazing.
Yeah. But the other thing that I love is that he has brought one of the birds, Sarge, who is the one on my arm in my author photo, and who lives at McGowell Park at Largo. When I was a kid growing up in Largo, we called it Largo Narrows Park. Our Sarge still lives there, and Sarge has come to two of my public events on on my Gulf of Mexico book, and it's been wonderful to have her there. And I'm going to be at an event here on the April 19th, Pints and Predators. The event is called at a local brew pub, and with another one of Patrick Bradley's Eagles, Thunder.
Oh boy!
Yeah,
very nice. Talk about the rehabilitation, and there are countless anecdotal stories of how spending time in nature with animals can soothe the soul, so to speak. But increasingly, I'm reading more about actual academic scientific studies that report a similar linkage of people who are able to spend any amount of time. It doesn't even have to be in wild places, just outdoors among some, some greenery and trees and shrubs, and the incredible psychological benefits that has for people.
Animal-assisted therapy has been around a long time, but using, you know, chickens and horses and, you know, parrots and cats and dogs. But Patrick, as far as we know, is the first one who's conducted animal-assisted therapy with birds of prey.
Nice. Well, that's what I liked about the book is, you know, we talk about how we sort of elevated the eagle. We put it on a pedestal and then we tried to kill it. And then we tried to bring it back. And now it's kind of helping some of us come back as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really how I feel. This success story is shown us that there is hope for the future. I think it's, you know, it's positive reinforcement that we rather than all the negativity. That I think we need when we're looking toward the future. And as I say in the book, when you see a bald eagle crossing the sky, that's a pat on our backs for doing right by nature. I mean, we're not perfect. No, don't get me wrong. We live in Florida and we know what it continues to happen here. And Florida is one of those paradoxes too, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we have this fantastic state park system. We now are working on this wildlife corridor, but some of the old habits of the past that are destructive continue in the state, even as we implement, you know, progressive measures.
Where is your favorite place in Florida to see bald eagles?
You know, I have to say Paynes Prairie up here in Gainesville, you know, just a 5-10 minute drive from my house, has been a fantastic place. Last year, the prairies, the water's a little higher up in the prairie this year, so you can't get very far out into it like you could last year. But last year, when you could go out there this time of year, you could go out to Paynes Prairie anytime in the morning or in the evening, which is feeding time, and see bald eagles fishing along with osprey, stealing from other eagles. I had a photographer out there with me, Justin Bright, who one day witnessed two eagles in midair, you know, an aerial battle, trading this fish between them five times.
Wow.
And fighting over it, you know. So that Paynes Prairie is a good place. Also right here, there are about a dozen active nests around Noonan's Lake. I was recently down at Three Lakes Wildlife Management Area, about 40 minutes or so south of Orlando. You can see some really beautifully built eagle's nests that are active as well. That's a good place. The Chaswawiska National Wildlife Refuge is another good place. You know, sometimes it's hit or miss. St. Mark's National Wildlife Refuge has a couple of eagles too. Yeah, but you know what? Where you guarantee to see them, and this is sad to say, is at the local landfill. I did a photo shoot with Sarasota Magazine a few weeks ago at the Sarasota County landfill. Yeah. And, you know, tens of thousands of birds, gulls and grackles and ibis and, you know, the stick-legged wading birds, but also bald eagles.
Yeah. Amazing. Jack Davis, The Bald Eagle, The Improbable Journey of America's Bird, by incredible coincidence, it publishes the very day this episode is going to publish. So congratulations. And we look forward to reading this one for sure.
And don't forget about the event, the Tom Butler Books event on March 5th at the Palladium with Colette Bancroft.
Yes.
Yes.
Who's also been a guest. Are you working on another one yet?
I haven't delved into it, but I've conceptualized another one. And surprise, surprise, it's a history of environmental successes.
Oh,
good.
So it's a short book.
Craig has spoken like a man on the front lines.
Thanks for your time, Jack.
Hey, thanks, always Jack. A pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me.
Certainly, Craig, the numbers for bald eagles are vastly improved, but it's still a special, special thing to see.
It is, absolutely. The you know, I have been you know, camping and canoeing and stuff like that for years. The first one I saw was on a float trip along the Rainbow River with my kids' Boy Scout troop. And we saw a couple of eagles soaring over, which was very exciting. And then I kind of ruined the ride by almost running over a family of otters with my float. Fortunately, they got out of the way in time. So. Yeah.
Well, it is a bird that is distributed through most, if not all, of the lower 48 states. And of course, Alaska has the largest population. Right. It does eat primarily fish. So all of the coastline in Alaska and the salmon runs and all of that is perfect for it. But, you know, I'm 46. So, you know, my formative years are in the 80s. And this is, you know, not long after DDT had been banned, not long after the Clean Water Act. It's hard for me to get across to people, and you'll certainly understand this, but that time, how incredibly rare it was to see a bald eagle, something we kind of take for granted, particularly in Florida now.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, he's right. This is an environmental success story, and I'm glad that he's telling it. Mm-hmm. And it's such a rich way so that people will really get the full flavor of it.
Yeah.
So,
one of those other great success stories, too, is the alligator. Yeah. I don't think people recognize at one time how low alligator populations got because of hunting.
Well, it's funny. I did a story a few years ago about there had been a scientific study of how people get bitten by alligators. And it won't surprise you any that the majority of people, the majority of Florida men in Florida getting bitten by alligators are guys going out to try and collect golf balls from detention ponds. But I asked the guy in charge of the survey, I said, well, how does this compare historically? He said, well, historically there weren't any alligator bites because there weren't any alligators. People weren't getting bitten by alligators because they just didn't see them. The alligators were nearly extinct. So they're a big success story.
Welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida. And stay out of the retention pond.